This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
One of the keynotes of today's proceedings has been that people have shared their feelings about Bob. Oh, sorry, Bob. I didn't mean to call you to order. People were sharing their feelings of Bob even then. He's that kind of guy. So people have been sharing their feelings about Bob, and we wanted to open the last session to people who haven't taken part in the formalities so far, but to offer an appreciation of Bob. Now, as we noticed earlier, there is a secret conspiracy here of South Australians and Scots. I was brought up in South Australia, and I'm married to a Scot. Accordingly, I will. The first comment I'll read comes from somebody who is an honorary South Australian, because he lives there now, and then the next three will be people who are definitely South Australians. So the rest of you will just have to put up with that, and then it'll open up to you. So first of all, can I read a very brief message from Craddock Morton, who is sorry he can't be here today. He's provided quite a long message, which I won't read out completely, but I'll give a copy to Bob, and I'll also give a copy to Polly to put onto the website. Craddock quotes a 17th century Japanese haiku in which you are compared to a frog. I won't read that out. Sorry. He then explains why he's comparing you to a frog. But Craddock says, among other things, that he wants to pay tribute to the support, encouragement and mentoring of a whole generation of students of Indigenous history, anthropology and the arts that Bob has provided. He says there is no one who is more respected by both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people alike. And I think that explains why the museum is so committed to this event. Finally, to embarrass Bob further, he says, Bob Edwards is one of the kindest, generous and self-effacing people I know. I'm very sad that I cannot be there with you today to celebrate his achievements in a way that he so richly deserves. And I'll give you a copy presently, Bob. Can I call upon now three notable, indeed distinguished South Australians? First of all, Dr. John Bannon, who's lurking in the middle. John's a former Premier of South Australia and was closely associated with Bob in that capacity. John. Yes, please, yes. It works. Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's great to have an opportunity to speak. Look, I will come down. I won't take much on it.
It's like an old-time revival.
The mic's
meeting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. How can a politician address an audience with his back to me?
Now, here's a challenge for me.
I won't be able to see the protests and such. Thanks, and I will be brief, but I'd just like to say that the focus of my remarks about Bob relate to a very intense, exciting, dynamic period in 1979-80, when he embarked on what became the Edwards Report, which has been referred to approvingly and with justification as one of the very significant things that have been done for museology in Australia, because it led to so many other things, not just in South Australia. And I just thought I'd give a quick background to that in reflections on Don. In the 70s, of course, under Don Dunstan, South Australia began to develop this great artistic and cultural reputation, which was fantastic. A real contrast, perhaps, to the dour days of Tom Playford. They were exciting, dynamic, inspiring times for many of us. But in his work in the arts and his promotion of the arts and culture, Don focused very much on the performing arts. This was the era of the State Theatre Company, the State Opera, the Film Corporation, the Dance Theatre. Most of these things were copied, like the Adelaide Festival of Arts, by other states and cities over the ensuing years. But they all started there. The thing about this is worth remembering, and what I'm going to say about Dunstan is the same as one could say about Neville Wran in New South Wales, who also took the portfolio of the arts and did some great things there. That Dunstan was very lonely in terms of support from cabinet, commitment from his caucus to these sorts of initiatives. Government was seen very much as, you know, the hospitals, the schools, the roads, the houses, the things like that, the nuts and bolts of government. This was a peripheral sort of activity. Don's advantage was that he was Premier, for one, and Treasurer, secondly. And in my 10 years there, I held both those portfolios myself, as well as the arts. But as I say, he was a lonely voice around the cabinet table. In fact, A number of his colleagues used to say, in pointing to the expenditure on the arts, well, of course, that's Don's indulgence. We have to sort of look after him because he'll be more kind on the hospital's vote or something like that as treasurer if we're prepared to concede something here. It's forgotten now where cultural and support of the arts is something that is really seen as fairly fundamental and important to governments, at least in terms of presentation. It wasn't so. And it was always hard to argue a case. And that's why a number of institutions in South Australia had languished, and languished fearfully, as we've already heard. So this was the scene at which in 1978 I became a young, fresh-faced minister in the Dunstan government, a new portfolio of community development. But what Dunstan did in putting into that portfolio was, of course, the arts responsibility. And he gathered up the various institutions, the art gallery, the museum, the library, the whole concept of the Constitutional Museum, as it was. The botanic gardens were even included and taken out of the Environment Department as the great cultural conserving institutions of the state. And his brief to me, and he said, I'll relinquish the arts portfolio. I do this with some regret, but I've got to concentrate on other things, and at least there's another voice now in Cabinet that can vote for some of the things we want to get done. But focus now on those institutions. And that's how the concept, the idea of doing a major report or study into the museum firstly, but it was broadened later into the interlocking institutions largely because that's how Bob conceived the job, came about. And it was very significant because there was a promise of some resources and a program behind it. So what were we looking for in this scene? I mean, we've already heard the deplorable state of the museum. In fact, one of the first things I did was take a special submission to Cabinet based on the deterioration and a report saying this needs to be addressed urgently of some of the filmic and other visual material in the museum, which was in an appalling state, unconserved, uncatalogued or whatever. And in aid of that, partly, I came across a marvellous reference in Sir Kenneth Clark's autobiography. He came to Adelaide, I think it was in 1947, and he describes visiting the institutions and the pleasant city of churches and so on, and he went to the museum. And he said, well, extremely impressive collection. For instance, he said, and I'm doing this from memory, I haven't got the quote in front of me because I couldn't track down the book, but he said, I was really impressed with their indigenous Australian ethnographic collection, extraordinary. There was heaps and heaps of it. And when I say heaps, I mean heaps, literally, lying about all over the place in a deplorable state. Now, that's 1947. Well, despite urgent curation, particularly under Bob's tutelage, things were still pretty desperate. So that's why this report became a central thing. Now, who do you get to do something like this? And this was the issue that myself and a couple of others, Bruce Guerin was an important part of this, were discussing. We wanted someone visionary, but we didn't want one of these grand reports. We had real practical issues of deterioration and urgent remediation needed, as well as within the context of a vision. And so you needed someone practical, someone who could get to the nitty-gritty of a project and actually finish and make practical suggestions and understood the exigencies of budget and the fact that you couldn't just build a castle in the air. Somebody with perseverance, with persistence. Somebody with knowledge. And I'm saying an individual, incidentally, because that was the other conclusion. We couldn't get this done by a committee or a board or a group. We wanted somebody to do it, to examine it and to lead it. A pretty special sort of individual was needed. Local knowledge was important. But we didn't want somebody either who was so entrenched in the local scene or entrenched in academia and the research of academia. And so one began to build a picture. And, of course, emerging out of this picture came inevitably Bob Edwards. Just reaching into his third stage of prime, I suppose it's fair to say, from the orchard, from Aboriginal curation into this area. it was just clearly the man for the job. Now, I happened to, and just to conclude in this little exercise, because I'm not going to tell you the whole story, I happened to pull out from my bookshelf before coming over here. I thought, I've got a couple of things Edwards wrote, and sure enough, there were two or three of them. And I found one of them. This was published by Rigby in 1970, Arnhem Land in Colour. And there's a marvellously glamorous sort of matinee idol picture of Bob and a little biog below it. And interestingly enough, it says, this is a book he co-authored with Bruce Guerin. Interestingly, it talks about his experience, background, his photographs. He's curator of anthropology. And he says, born in 1930, married with four children, and his home has always been in Adelaide. We thought, there's a man. Incidentally, the second book I pulled down was one I've got, Aboriginal Bark Canoes in the Murray Valley, a splendid publication. 2 years later, published again by Rigby, 1972. Exactly the same biography, exactly the same matinee idol photograph, but surprisingly, his home has always been in Adelaide, is missing from the blurb. Perhaps this indicated Bob was already on the move. His sights were moving beyond the parochial and outside. And it's just as well, because if he hadn't been outside Adelaide, if he hadn't extracted himself, he couldn't have come back and done the job he did, among all the jealousies and institutional rivalries and terrible history that he had to deal with. He came, he saw, he conquered. He was superb. It was a visionary and marvellous report that still, as Suzanne Miller says, has carriage to this very day. The exercise got bigger, but the practical aspects of it didn't. For instance, the art lab, the conservation centre, the combined conservation, was one of the things that came out of that very quickly. There was the creation of the History Trust, and various other things followed. Now, in saying that, and I've told you about the role I played in appointing Bob, just a few days before Don Dunstan resigned, and our hearts fell because we thought, you know, Des Corcoran, his successor, the kind of yang to Don's ying, had been his loyal deputy for many years, had become premier, and he wasn't terribly interested in the arts, culture or those things. He was a public works man. In fact, the Opera Theatre was due to open a few days after Don's unexpected and tragic resignation. And the Premier was due to open it. Des Corcoran said to me, you go and do that, lad, you know, it's all right. You're the arts minister, you know about this arty-farty stuff. I said, Des, it's important that at the beginning of your premiership you show yourself at least a little committed, and they're expecting you. So finally he agreed to come, only on condition that he could come on stage, open the theatre, and then leave. He didn't have to sit through the bloody opera all night, you know. So he did. An ironical footnote to this, if you go to Her Majesty's Theatre in Adelaide, which was opened in February 1979, and look at the plaque, it says opened by Premier the Honourable Don Dunstan. They didn't bother to change the plaque. That's another story. It was in that environment at that time that Bob came to do this marvellous job. But the government fell 6 months later. We'd already got a few things agreed and in the pipeline. To its great credit, the government of David Tonkin and Murray Hill picked up the report, picked up a lot of the initiatives and steered it on and through. When we returned to office in 1982, by then as Minister of the Arts, I was also Treasurer, which was quite handy. We were able to get many of the museums and other things accomplished and developed.
And there the story ends.
There the story ends, because nobody but Bob could have transcended all the difficulties he had in Adelaide at that time, and the politics and the change of government. What an extraordinary character.
And the next speaker, and I think the last before we hear from someone else, is Michael Treloar, a well-known Adelaide antiquarian bookseller with whom Bob has a very long and expensive relationship. Well, Michael, you may as well use that.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm not given to envy, least of all of politicians, but the ability to speak on one's feet and off the cuff is something that I know I'll never master. But one thing about a written account is you'll know I'll be finished in about 4.5 minutes. Starting now. I was born in South Australia, and for many years I've been a self-employed antiquarian bookseller in Adelaide, with my main shop on North Terrace. I don't mind if any conspiracy theorists read a lot more into these facts than there actually is. My short tribute is Bob seen more through the microscope than the telescope, and accordingly it will be more personal. So I apologise in advance, especially to Bob. Bob's interest in books, more than that, his interest in book collecting, indeed in collection building, extends well beyond the 60 years I've been alive, let alone the mere 35 years I've been in business. His major collecting areas include not only Australian Aboriginal history, about which you all know, but also the theory and practice of colonisation, as exemplified by the experiments in South Australia, New Zealand, Canada and elsewhere. Also South Australiana, stemming from his pioneering background. But clearly his range of interests is much broader and includes, obviously, photography, the many subjects relating to the major exhibitions he has been involved with, and family history and genealogy, his current passions. As you learned this morning, his superb Aboriginal history collection book collection and archive is now in the hands of the National Museum, and it is worthy of both his name and this institution on the three primary criteria of any collection: content, form, and condition. I've confirmed through the immediate past librarian that access is readily available to this fine collection through the library. To my mind, books are fundamentally different to other items of commerce, and the bookseller is probably unique in the relationship that he can develop with his clientele. When one thinks of judges, lawyers, policemen, doctors, nurses, orderlies, market gardeners, plumbers, waiters, pilots, public servants, even teachers and students, one's colleagues may well be friends, but one's customers, clients, patients, pupils, rarely. Not so with bookselling. In fact, the competitive nature of the game ensures that one keeps one's colleagues at arm's length. But buying a book is often a very personal matter, and the quotidian shopkeeper-customer role can, over time, evolve into something much more meaningful, occasionally into friendship, such is the case with Bob. Although he has been on my mailing list for well over 25 years, and we would occasionally meet at interstate book fairs, it is his recently relinquished position on the board of the South Australian Museum that I have much to be thankful for. Prior to most of his regular visits from his Sydney home to Adelaide, Bob would ring me and arrange a mutually convenient time to visit my shop. Occasionally, I would get a call with little or no notice. The round of meetings had finished earlier than expected. Are you free? Happily for me, and I think for Bob too, it was rare that we could not get together on these visits. Usually I'd be busy when he arrived, so he would have some welcome free time in which to browse unhindered. He often purchased titles of which he had already given away multiple copies. I can assure Nick Peterson, I think it was this morning, who mentioned those 5 copies of Plumley. I know Bob has a copy. He bought one from me only a few years ago. Then I would show Bob some special item, sometimes in one of his collecting areas. But because his collections were so well formed by the time I really got to know him, it was more often than not in one of those show-and-tell scenes, a harmless pursuit so enjoyed by boys of all ages. I'm not sure if women are so inclined. If you're not, you're missing out on something. Sometimes I would share the news of a forthcoming project or purchase. Bob was always so interested and encouraging and enthusiastic, and he made it very easy to respond to these generous characteristic traits. This is something that has come out time and time and time again today, and I can only reinforce it on a one-to-one basis from my own experience. We would then generally retreat to a nearby coffee shop, sometimes a restaurant, and enjoy each other's company and conversation. This would often quickly leave the world of books behind and become more private and personal. Much of those conversations will remain so. But over the years, I learnt of Kath's gradual decline and of Bob's loving care and attention for her. But I also was delighted to learn much about his early childhood and school days, and of his grandfather and the glory days of the family vineyard in what is now an anonymous suburban Adelaide. The life and times alluded to by Dick Richards are something that I've heard from Bob's own mouth. I would reciprocate with anecdotes drawn from my own life and experiences. And I think the act of sharing these sorts of stories is surely at the heart of friendship, which is the essence of a full and a fulfilling life. I've been privileged to know Bob at this level, and I'm honoured to be invited to share these few recollections with all of you today. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Michael. Now, you'll see that on the screen it says short contributions from John, Michael and audience. And the audience will be represented today by Alan Smith, who will speak very, very briefly. And the reason he is because as we've come to the end of the afternoon, you'll notice that the contributions and the offerings are becoming more and more personal. Michael has a personal relationship with Bob, and Alan has, going back some years. But you've still only got 1 minute.
Quickly. We've had the great joy today of hearing of so many different facets of Bob's life. There's been one facet that's only been very lightly touched on, and that's his role as mentor. Bob has been my deeply loved mentor for more than 3 decades now and has helped me enormously through all my career. But I have one very strong memory of very early on in my career where I faced the most enormous difficulties. I was only an historian at the time, the lowest of the low, and I discovered that some of my staff were systematically stealing from the collection, took it to my then boss, and nothing appeared to happen. And then I realised my boss was the biggest rogue of them all. Except one does have to admire the ingenuity of someone who managed to put the private lease of a Porsche on the office taxi voucher account. And when you're faced with that situation, who do you go to? You go to your mentor, and my mentor was Bob. And in a one-hour meeting, he gave me all the advice I needed, and in that very, very rare occasion in the arts, in that case, the good triumph and the wicked went to jail.
Thanks, Alan. A cautionary tale. Now, you'll see it says contributions from audience. Isn't it here? Yes, right. The member of the audience that we'll have up to the podium next is, in fact, Bob himself. We thought Bob might not want to speak, so we didn't put it on the programme. But in the course of the days, Bob's changed his mind. So, ladies and gentlemen, Bob Edwards, and you can speak as long as you like.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thought that by now you'd be completely exhausted and have had enough speeches, so I didn't expect to speak, but I felt in my mind that there were a few things that I did want to say. Well, I found it a very touching day for me. There certainly could be no more enjoyable occasion than coming together and looking back on many years of shared experiences. It brought back fond memories of the intense activity in which so many of us were involved as changes came to Aboriginal Australia, to the arts and to our museums and our galleries. Although the focus has been mainly on my life, it has been more about the achievements of the many colleagues with whom I've collaborated on so many projects over a number of decades. It's only in recent years that I've looked back and contemplated the past. What stands out is my good fortune in having been given so many opportunities to contribute in to contribute to matters in which I had a keen and ongoing interest and concern. I realised at the time that opportunities come with high expectations, the need for firm commitments, and a determination to succeed, because I found to be otherwise would be to disappoint the trust of those I had held in very high regard. The first of many opportunities came as a complete surprise when I was offered the position of Curator of Anthropology at the South Australian Museum. This was on the retirement of its first curator, Norman Tindale. I could not believe my good fortune, as my lifelong dream of working in a museum had suddenly become a reality. The year was 1965, I was 35, had a lovely wife, four sons, a secure position in the fruit marketing industry, and fascinating hobbies studying ancient rock art, stone tool making, exploring the richness and diversity of the Aboriginal heritage, as well as a passion for collecting Australiana, which you've heard about. My next opportunity followed quickly when John Mulvaney and several colleagues decided, quite correctly I might say, that I needed considerably more field experience before taking up the position 6 months later and following in the very large footsteps of such an experienced curator as Norman Tindale. The 6 months passed with over 12,000 kilometres of travel in Arnhem Land and Central Australia in the closing months of a terrible 10-year drought. I was indeed very much wiser and more than ever determined to become a good curator. On taking up my new position at the museum, I prepared a summary report on the survey of rock art sites and catalogued my photographs. But from that day on, I became very busy as opportunities arose with ever-increasing frequency. 45 years were to pass before I had time to read the copious notes penned under the glow of the campfire late each night on what could only be called my initiation trip. I read my first impressions of the beauty and vastness of the landscape and the generosity of the people I encountered. My admiration for the Aboriginal elders who taught me so much by sharing a little of their profound knowledge, their wisdom, dignity, good humour and beliefs. I had noted my concerns about the breakdown of a rich ancient heritage under the then prevailing policies of assimilation. I was shocked by the appalling living conditions of a proud people. My time in the field also reinforced my belief in the role of museums as the great repositories of knowledge and ideas, the conservators, the protectors, the researchers of rich, diverse cultures, and the very great storytellers and disseminators of knowledge, all traditions that had flowed down from the days of the Enlightenment when the great British Museum was established and set an example to the world. As I was reading through my notes, I began to realise that the observations made on my first outback journey had subconsciously set the agenda for many years ahead. My first contacts with this other Australia had so affected me that I attempted in my own way to make a difference wherever it was possible. Among my later opportunities came an offer from the then Federal Minister of Arts, Bob Bellicott, to assist him in setting up an effective management organisation to bring international exhibitions to Australia in collaboration with national and state collecting institutions. Today, Art Exhibitions Australia continues to contribute to the enrichment of the cultural life of the community. Having been the beneficiary of so many exciting opportunities extended by others, I have in turn given high priority to creating opportunities for those who wish to pursue common goals. The outcome is, as you've seen today, a network of wonderful friends who continue to share in the desire to make a difference in the preservation of Aboriginal heritage and provide opportunities for us all to appreciate the diversity and richness of world art. Today has been about sharing the challenges and the satisfaction of having aspired to make a difference. It has also provided me with a welcome opportunity to express appreciation to so many of my friends who have shared the journey and continue to do so today. Thank you all for joining us today, and special thanks to Philip, Carol, Andrew, Peter and the speakers and organisers who have made the day such a very great success. And what a great pleasure it was to have Neil McGregor join us. Thank you very much.
Well, Bob, thank you very much. It's been the most marvellous day, and I want to thank some people. I thank, firstly, all of you who today have come here to share in this tribute Bob's life and career, and to share a friendship with him and to honour him. I want to thank particularly all the speakers who've spoken today. And I want to thank Philip Jones, our 2010-11 Directors Fellow here, who has developed the program for today. And without that assistance, the tribute would not have been the great success that it has been. So thank you, Philip. And I want to thank Art Exhibitions Australia, especially Carol Henry and Carol Sweeney, who supported the tribute financially and in many other ways. There are many staff at the museum I'd like to thank. I'd like to thank Peter Stanley, and from our public programs, Rachel Coghlan, Heidi Pritchard and Leanne Dempsey, and especially Anne Farris from the Centre for Historical Research here today, who's put such a great effort in, and Polly Templeton, who has assisted in recording the proceedings. There are many people who are unable to be here today, who particularly wanted to send, who sent messages, and who particularly wanted to send their expressions of regard. Philip Adams, Piers Ackerman, Laurie Benson, Peter Brockenshire, Ray Choate, Jim Cousins, Janet Holmes-Acourt, Dave Epstein from the United States, Sir James Gobbo, Colin Hope, Kate Kahn, Patrick McKackie, John McPhee, Christopher Menz, Harold Mitchell, Koji Miura, Bales Meyer, Rupert Meyer and Sarah Meyer, Timothy Potts, Hans Ewald Schneider, Tom Stanage, Maruk Tarapur, Jared Vaughan and Anthony Wallace. They've all been with us here in spirit today. So thank you very much, and thank you very much, Bob Edwards.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.